From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
Peter Ames Carlin returns to the show this week. He's the author of several fine biographies of music greats, including Catch a Wave, The Rise and Fall and Redemption of the Beach Boys' Brian Wilson. Paul McCartney, A Life, a biography of Springsteen titled simply Bruce, or Bruce, if you prefer, and Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. In 2021, Peter Ames Carlin published Sonic Boom, The Impossible Rise of Warner Brothers, and now he has an exciting new book. The name of this band is R.E.M. Peter Ames Carlin, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for having me again. It's good to see you.
I think it's been close to 20 years since we first talked on this show.
Oh, wow. Was that for the, that must have been for the Brian Wilson book.
Yeah.
Terrific.
You look the same.
As do you.
Yeah, no, I don't. But you still have a lot of hair. It's pretty great. So, how did you come to write a book about REM?
Well, you know, it's such a fascinating story, and one of the things that's so compelling about them was, for me, at any rate, the extent to which I didn't really know much about them, given that, I mean, as humans, as individuals, because they had been so successful in drawing kind of a hard line around, you know, their personal lives versus their work. And as opposed to virtually every other musician I've ever written about, you know, about whom I went into it knowing a lot about, you know, their backgrounds and their personal lives, because that's kind of sort of the coin of the realm, you know, when you're selling creative work, you know, you end up getting interviewed and having to spill things about how you felt about your parents or, you know, or who you're dating or who you were married to. You know, it's a sort of, you know, people kind of share that sort of whatever operatic aspect of their personal lives. But what was interesting about REM was, as much as I knew their work and as immensely famous as they were, you know, at their height back in the 90s, you never really knew that, like, Peter Buck, the guitar player, had been married twice at the peak of REM's fame. And there, I think there were an interview or two where he just mentioned you know, the name of his wife, or that came up, and what she did. You know, you didn't hear like, oh, well, and then we had these issues, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's like every other musician, like Keith Richards, you know, or, you know everything about who he was with and what their, you know, what their situation was. But these guys were very, you know, they really sort of kept, you know, kind of kept their personal lives personal. You know, there was a point in the mid 90s where Michael Stipe's sexual orientation became a matter of public record. He began to talk about it because he had kept it to himself for so long. But the media, you know, by the early 90s, as they became more successful, became increasingly obsessed with whether he was gay or straight, and whether, you know, there was some implication that maybe he had AIDS, you know, and this was at the height of the, you know, or the depths, I could say, of the AIDS crisis. And so he eventually, you know, after basically being kind of railroaded into it, finally said, okay, forget it. I'm going to speak my truth here.
Well, this band is the first band that you've written about, I think, that is more of your generation. I mean, all the other guys you've written about are,
yeah,
older. Did that make a difference in the writing?
In a sense, it was, because their, you know, their sort of cultural background and their experience of being, you know, kids in the 70s and going to high school in the 70s and going to college in the early 80s was also mine. I mean, they're a few years older than me. They're kind of older brother. I mean, the previous guys I'd written about were all old enough to be my dad, essentially. And these guys are just big brother type figures. But it was sort of interesting because I also was aware of, I perceived the rise of punk rock and, and the whole sort of, the stuff that they were tuned into in the 70s was also stuff I was tuned into. And so they were just like really cool older siblings.
I guess, except for Springsteen, the other guys, Paul's and Brian, were already well established as famous people before you were born or before you became cognizant of music. And now this is a band that you must remember when they, I mean, I certainly remember when they arrived.
And it was one of the things that was cool in the early 80s was the fact that, like, here's a band that's like making it that's super influential and they're completely recognizable to me, not just generationally, but also they were college kids. They read books that I read, they sort of, it was like, oh, it was that moment, now, 45 years later or whatever, where you first began to recognize people who were influential in the culture as being your peers, your generational peers. And you hang on to, it's kind of neat to be in the demo of young, successful people, even if you're not a successful person yourself. It's like, oh, people can do this. It's like people our age are actually making an impact. Cool. So that was kind of neat. It's amazing. You're sort of on top of the world for, where you and your generational cohort are kind of on top of the world for 10 or 15 or maybe 20 years. And then you start to feel yourself slipping away. And now it's like, I'm at the point, generationally where I'm like, oh, people my age are still making an impact. How inspiring. It's like, even though we're all so creaky and old at this point and should have long since surrendered the spotlight to younger folk.
Well, speaking of that, the other week there was a special on NBC celebrating the 50th anniversary of Saturday Night Live, and two of your subjects, Paul Simon and Paul McCartney, performed on the show. Did you see it? Did you have any thoughts?
The 50th anniversary of SNL? Nah, I didn't watch it. But I remember that first season of Saturday Night Live. I mean, I remember watch, being very aware of its, when it was the revolutionary new thing, when Lorne Michaels was like this extremely hip 31-year-old kid who actually got to run a network show, and that was a big part of the story was like young, powerful hippies, like cool. It's like the hippie people are finally actually getting the keys to mainstream media now, and that was kind of the vibe of that show. And it was so exciting. And you saw stuff on that show that was so revolutionary and felt like, how could this possibly be on network TV? I mean, in the REM story, by the time they began to make their first appearances in media, it was Late Night with David Letterman.
Right.
And I remember, I was in college when that came on. And I just remember tuning in and just being like, how is this on TV? It's like, how could they have possibly be allowing this guy to do this stuff? And that was a really precious kind of feeling. And so of course, I mean, the beginning of the book, the foreword is set at their first REM's first appearance on Late Night with David Letterman. And that incredible sensation of here's a band that has no hits. And not only are they going to be allowed to perform on a network TV show, they're going to be allowed to perform twice. And the second song is a song that's like, that is so new, it doesn't even have a title yet, and that was, I have a memory of seeing that when it was on, and I don't know if I caught it in a rerun or I don't know if, I mean, because it's been more than 40 years at this point, but it was like you see it now and it's like, they're just kids, you know, they're college kids. They're up there, and you could kind of get that look on their faces of like, holy shit, I can't believe we're on TV. So, and that's how they felt. You know, they made it very clear later that they couldn't believe they were getting to be able to do this.
Well, you were talking a little bit about the mystery of the band, and I think that's I got that out of your book, that that's a really a big part of their success. I think they were able to kind of put something over on us in a way, in that they're really a pop band. You mentioned the Monkees in the book, and or the Left. It's always a band I think of when I think of REM. They're very melodic, and they have a lot of harmonies, and their songs are really tuneful. But they have an appearance of being a harder edged band than they really are. I think the mystery of who they are, and the fact that you mentioned in the book, the name of this band is REM, Peter Ames Carlin. You mentioned that they were very careful when recording their first album to make sure you couldn't understand anything they were saying.
Well, they, you know, I mean, one of the things that they understood was that there's a distinction between that you can be edgy and you can explore difficult ideas and concepts, you know, and uncomfortable things without necessarily, you know, making a grating noise, you know. So they were much more focused on creating work that was, you know, that could push the boundaries without necessarily becoming, you know, amelodic or dissonant, you know, that they could, that you could explore dissonant ideas and uncomfortable feelings without necessarily just going, you know, I mean, and in some ways it was that sort of their enthusiasm for the Monkees and pop music and being able to weave that together with kind of accessible sounds and stuff that that was part of what made them so magical, you know. And it's sort of, it's a rare and precious thing, you know. I mean, they always put me in mind, there was a point when they were at their height that where they really reminded me of the Beatles in their ability to not just kind of be at, you know, on the leading edge of where culture was going, but their ability to express complicated ideas and feelings that people were having and hadn't really put their fingers on yet. And not only put their fingers on it, but do it in a way where it was, you know, it sort of passed that pop test of being accessible and, you know, and sort of easy to sort of wrap your arms around, but you know, at least in terms of how it sounded and how, you know, while at the same time knowing that there were a lot of really complicated, you know, feelings and ideas, and maybe even some darkness that's coming through this music.
Well, in a song like Sitting Still, is Michael Stipe saying anything or not?
Sure. I mean, he speaks in this kind of, I mean, especially in the early days, you know, he was, you know, he was using this kind of impressionistic sort of imagist way of describing and almost really mostly alluding to feelings and ideas and situations without speaking in specific narrative terms. And to some extent, that might have been because he was less, you know, confident of his ability to write in a more kind of recognizable way. But on the other hand, I think it also, you know, it's a style of writing that can be very powerful and it leaves a lot to the imagination and it leaves a lot to, you know, to each listener's interpretation. And that was really, you know, and that was the other reason why they didn't publish the lyrics for the longest time. It's because, you know, they wanted, he really wanted his words and his voice to be more a part of the larger texture of the song than standing out and being at the fore, kind of telling you how to feel about what you're hearing. He wanted each listener to be able to sort of apply their own interpretation. And one of the things that they were sort of perversely proud of is that when people wrote in to say, am I hearing this correctly? And with their own sort of transcription of the lyrics, when it was completely wrong, you know, they said sometimes it was better, you know, and we started using those words instead, which is kind of hilarious. And, but you know, but so you could sort of see what the virtue of that was. But then later, when, as you know, by the middle part of the 80s, you know, in the second half of the 80s, when he began to feel, when they as artists began to feel like they wanted to incorporate more sort of political and social and cultural commentary, and he felt kind of like he could step into this role of being something of a generational leader, you know. I think at that point he became more interested in being, you know, in having that kind of leadership position and having his voice and, you know, being able to step out a little bit and have people understand precisely what he's trying to say.
Of course, one of the joys of looking at your previous subjects, you know, one of the joys of California Girls or Paperback Writer or Feeling Groovy is singing along in the car when the song comes on the radio. And this,
yeah,
if you sing along with REM, it's iffy that you're singing what they're singing.
But if you feel like, but I think for a lot of fans of those early songs, you know, feeling as if you understand so, that you and Michael are on the same wavelength, you know, I think a lot of that feeling as though one was on the same wavelength with this band, you know, I think that was a big, you know, that was something that really drew those early fans. It was like when you heard this music and when you understood what its value was, and how clear, you know, and you felt seen in that way, I think you felt like you were part of a kind of exclusive club. And it was a club of people who's, you know, in some ways were members as a result of what maybe made them seem unacceptable to the more popular kids. You know, it wasn't music for popular kids at first. It was music for outcasts and rejects. And, but then suddenly you know, it's like that feeling you get when you finally meet the people who get you, you know, when you're a teenager. And at first, you know, you stumble around and you feel like a loser, but then you find these cool kids who totally understand where you're coming from and you're accepted. And the thing that made you unacceptable makes you exclusive now. And I think there was a lot of that feeling for early fans of REM. Of like, I've spent my whole life feeling like an outcast, but these really cool guys who are making this cool music that hardly anyone get, they know that I'm actually extraordinary. And I think that was a big part of the appeal for those early REM fans.
Some of the clues to REM come in the songs they covered, and they continued, you know, pretty much throughout their career to do interesting covers of songs.
Yeah. You know, in the early days, I mean, that was one of the things, I mean, in Athens, where there were so many of these kind of art, I mean, it was such an interesting little subculture there in this tiny little town in, you know, northeastern Georgia, because so much of the local music scene, or at least the cool part of the music scene, involved kids who were students at the university's art school. And there was sort of among the faculty and the students there a sort of a shared aesthetic and I think a real admiration for like punk music and for folk culture and folk artists and the idea that expression that the purest expression you know an artistic expression didn't necessarily require, you know, really sophisticated craft. You know, you didn't need to be a sophisticated sculptor to make a brilliant, you know, transcendent sculpture in the same way. And so understanding that and sort of asserting those values into music, it was, you know, it sort of began as a punk rock, sort of an extension of punk rock, but then became, you know, a very different kind of artistic music. But a lot of those bands, a lot of the most successful and influential bands out of Athens, like the B-52s, Pylon, you know, and others, the Side Effects, and, you know, they were, you know, Love Tractor, they were people who decided to form a band and then decided who was going to have to learn to play which instrument, you know. And so, and a lot of these bands got started up and they were, you know, formed by kids who had never played instruments before. And a lot of what they were trying to do was to create an artistic sound, an expression that was somehow, not a function of years and years of musical training. And weirdly, you take a band like Pylon and their inability to perform like any other musicians, because they just couldn't play well enough, actually was, central to their aesthetic and central to their expression.
Also, I was impressed with in your book, Peter Ames Carlin, the name of this band is REM. I was impressed that the band took into account the ways that all other bands have fallen apart and made a decision to be kind of the opposite decision that Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers made, right? I mean, Tom Petty became Tom Petty, and they were the Heartbreakers rather than Michael Stipe and REM or whatever. They all were equal members, including their manager.
Well, they, one of the things about them that's interesting is that despite the fact that like Peter Buck had never played in a band really before REM, he was, obsessed with playing guitar when he was in high school. He just played by himself, or he had one friend who he used to jam with, but he really didn't want to play like, Clapton or Jeff Beck. He didn't want to be like one of these super fast, super articulate guitar players. He wanted to be a member of a band. And he, the idea of a band and the idea of, being part of a larger whole was what appealed to him. And so one of the things that he learned was, I mean, his reading of, the literature of, rock magazines and everything was, and reading about other bands' careers, he understood, as difficult as it was to become successful, and as hard as people had to work, it was compelling that when bands became successful, it was never very long before they began to dissolve. And one of the things that, that tears a band apart, as he came to understand, was the conflicts about credit, songwriting credit, and then inevitably royalties. Because as much money as a band can make from performing and selling records, you could make even more money if you also owned the publishing of the songs. Like that's where the generational wealth came from. And so, in order to guard against that happening to their band, he said, and this is before I think they even had one, indie record out, we are all going to be credited equally for each song that we write. And then if there any money flows from publishing, we will all profit equally, no matter who wrote any individual song. And part of what made that easier for them was the fact that all four members were, contributed to the songwriting. They were all pretty, pretty accomplished songwriters and musicians, ultimately, or at least in their ability to kind of write songs and stuff. And so, that was, a big core part of their commitment to their band and to one another.
Yeah, the classic story. I think it's the Birds, where suddenly Gene Clark shows up in a Rolls Royce while the rest of them are still driving a beat up car because, well, he was the one that got the songwriting credits and suddenly started making all this money. Or even recently, George Harrison, Paul McCartney was talking about "And I Love Her" in a, I think in that George Harrison documentary, and he says the da-da-dum part. Well, that was all George. And yet George had any songwriting credit there. There, the Lennon and McCartney songwriting was very dominant, obviously. But Ringo never gets any royalties except for Octopus's Garden.
And don't pass me by. And for that matter, if we're going to be pedantic here, what goes on which was on Rubber Soul in England and eventually here as well. But yeah, that was a co-write with Ringo and John and Paul, like the only, I think, three-way co-write, because it was his original idea and then they turned it into a song. But you're exactly right. And I think for Peter, I asked Peter Buck about it, and he said that he was reading in Rolling Stone, I think, about Jefferson Airplane, or excuse me, Jefferson Starship. It was right after the time, because they had that surprise hit single in the mid-70s with Miracles that Marty Balin wrote. And that record sold like 3 million copies, and suddenly they were swimming in publishing royalties, but only Marty Balin because of he wrote that one song. And then I think the people who wrote songs on the other song on the other songs on the records. But then what happened was the drummer, this was Peter's memory, I haven't read the article. The drum, you know, when it's time to make the next record, the drummer was like, "Wait a minute, I need to be able to write songs. Because I want to get publishing royalties too." And so they had to put some of his songs on the record, and it was like, you know, apparently he wasn't as accomplished at writing songs as some of the rest of them. But it became a, you know, it was a huge conflict. And then they began shedding members left and right.
Yeah,
So, you know, there you go.
about 10 minutes. That's really one of the most beautiful things that I got out of the book that you wrote about REM. REM kind of have two phases: the early phase when they were on IRS, and then when they go to Warner Brothers, the music is just different. You can understand the lyrics for one thing, and the lyrics are much more. Well, you can hear them, so you know what they are a lot easier, and the singing is very different. You wrote a book about Warner Brothers Records. How did it happen that everything changed at Warner Brothers?
You mean change for REM when they got onto Warners? Well, they had been moving in that direction the entire time, and in a way, their hot, you know, their sort of more modern era actually begins with Document, which was the last record they made for IRS. You know, that was the first one that included a top 10 single, you know, in The One I Love. Which was also the first, you know, so, and it was the first album of theirs to go platinum, to sell more than 1 million copies. And there had been a process, and I think it had accelerated with Life's Rich Pageant, and where, you know, and that was produced by the guy who was John Mellencamp's producer at the time, who they brought in as, you know, to work with them, Don Gaiman, because they just liked the sound of Mellencamp's records. You know, Gaiman was particularly good at making punchy rock and roll songs that included like natural instruments, like mandolins and fiddles and stuff. And they were kind of moving in a more elaborate direction musically. But Gaiman also encouraged Michael to not only revise his lyrics, you know, and really sharpen the lyrics, but then put his vocals out in front. And it was kind of a disagreement between them for a while. And he said Michael would get quite cross when he would say, "What are you doing in this lyric? Like, I don't understand the third verse. Doesn't make any sense. Like, why don't you make that make sense?" And Michael would get mad and maybe even storm out of the studio. But then when he came back the next day, he had sharpened the verse. And anyway, so, you know, and then Document, if you go back and listen to that, I mean, and again, and that's a pretty political record that has, you know, you begin to, you know, the words become much more clear, and the sound of his singing, the performance itself becomes more upfront and, you know, less a part of just the texture of the song. And so when they got to Warners, it was like, you know, they had moved even another step in that direction. But they, you know, one of the reasons they signed with Warners was, or one of the central reasons was because they understood that, you know, almost alone among the major labels, and particularly a label as major as Warner that had, you know, made, you know, that had, you know, a huge corporation behind them, that they were very sort of art forward and very, you know, and really allowed their artists to make exactly the type of music they wanted to make without, you know, corporate, you know, without real intervention saying this has to be more commercial. They might have suggestions like Lenny Waronker or Mo Austin or whomever, but they didn't require them to, you know, to change anything in order to be more radio friendly. And so that was why they chose REM, or excuse me, that's why REM chose Warner's as their label. And obviously the contract that they negotiated was very explicit in that the band controls their work.
And
Period.
why did they leave IRS, the band, the label that had pioneered them?
Well, they didn't, they would go tour Europe, and IRS didn't have very strong distribution overseas. And so they would go, they'd be in Germany or whatever. I mean, Bill Berry tells the story. And you would go into a town where they're about to play, and none of the record stores had their records in them, and people hadn't really heard of them because IRS just didn't have the muscle overseas to distribute their records as, as deeply as they need to be in order to make an impact, in order to really, get the attention of record buyers and concert goers. And what they understood was that Warner, I mean, one of the things that Warner's could offer, and in some ways it was the best of both worlds. They had this sort of big corporate backing so that they had this huge international distribution network. But on the other hand, you could go to their offices in Burbank and the top executives were really cool, and were sort of like, yeah, whatever you're doing is great. Like, we love this stuff. And, maybe there were times when Lenny Waronker, who was the president of Warner's at the time, would go hear their early stuff, and say, well, I kind of suggest that in this song, you might want to do X, and on this other song, you might want to do Y. And they would look at his memo and go, eh, and not do it. And he'd be like, okay, like, I trust you guys. It's like, that was my sensibility. That was my feeling, but it's like, you have a different feeling. You're the artist, you're the young people, you have a connection to your audience that I might not understand. And Lenny, I talked to Lenny, for the book, and he was like, he said, like, one of the big calls he made was when they were finishing out of time, he didn't think Losing My Religion was going to be a good single. And he was like, you know what? That's not your single. You should do Radio Song. That's your single right there. But then Scott Litt, who was their producer at the time, wrote to Lenny or called him up and said, listen, they have a relationship with their audience that you and I don't understand. But if they feel like this is what's going to connect, it's probably what's going to connect. And Lenny was like, okay. And so they put out Losing My Religion. It was a smash, the biggest hit they ever had. And Lenny, was like, yeah. So he goes, Scott really saved my ass on that one. So anyway, but that was part of the reason why, you signed with Warner's, is because you get Lenny Waronker as the president of your company. And he's very art forward, and he has a great deal of respect and empathy for artists, and he is willing to understand that they may know more about their art than he does.
I'm sure you refer to this in your book about the label, but the fact that that label was they nurtured their stars. That is, they let people make a first album, a second album, a third album before the albums started selling.
Well, that was the whole thing that Peter Buck was, I think, the voice in the band who at first said we should take a really close look at Warner Brothers, because he, as he told me, when he was a teenager living in this, kind of boring suburb of Atlanta, he could get these Warner's records like in the late 60s and early 70s that were like so far beyond what any other label would do, because that was in the day when, in the when Mo Austin first got control over Warner Brothers, he and Joe Smith, they, like in 1967 and 66, they immediately began to, those were the days when Frank Sinatra was still having hit singles and there was pop music was very light and frothy, but they anticipated that the baby boom generation, the hippie generation, were going to, start to dictate tastes very quickly. And so they began to take music so much more seriously, and they signed the Grateful Dead, and they signed Jimi Hendrix. And this is before anybody had ever heard of these guys. You know, they were just weird, scary hippies from San Francisco, you know, in the Dids, you know, or, you know, and Hendrix came out of Seattle, but had really kind of more broken through in London. And so what Peter understood was they've spent all this time cultivating artists, and not just the Dead and Hendrix, but also like Randy Newman didn't sell records for like 10 years. Van Dyke Parks was one of their primary artists, and he never sold records, you know, to this day. And he was on Warner's putting out major label records for 30 years before they went their separate ways, you know, after Mo and Lenny left Warner's. Because they just thought, well, Van Dyke is like this great artist, you know, just because he doesn't have a mainstream following doesn't mean he doesn't deserve to have a major label contract. And what they also understood was if you keep Van Dyke on the label, the next cool band who's full of cool musicians, but also can kind of do the thing of having a major label, you know, or having mainstream appeal, they're going to want to sign with us because we have Van Dyke. And in fact, that's why, you know, Peter was a Van Dyke Parks fan. And one of the things he was like, we should sign with this label that has Van Dyke Parks. And so they did. And so you can sort of see the intelligence. Yes, we, you know, these other artists are going to subsidize Van Dyke Parks' records. But then there's going to be new artists, new generations of artists who come on and make unfathomable amounts of money for us because of Van Dyke.
Those Warner Brothers samplers that they used to put out record sets with crazy things on them and unreleased tracks. And those guys were record store guys. So they must have loved those samplers as much as I did.
Yeah. The Lost Leaders. And I think that's some of the stuff that was what Peter was listening to in Georgia. You know, I mean, I remember when my dad came home with one of those Lost Leaders in like the second one or something, record show, I think it was, in like 1969. And I was like, I was little then, but I was a big Beatles fan and Monkees fan. So I was like super into pop music. And I remember him putting that record on and just going like, what the hell is, you know, some of it seems, you know, Cinnamon Girl was on it. I could wrap my arms around that. And there were some other songs that I was like, but then there was like Van Dyke Parks's early like synthesizer meanderings. And it was like, what the hell? It's like, but it, that seemed to me like, well, I guess that's just what pop music is. So.
Yeah. Well, at least in the eyes of Warner Brothers. The influence of Patti Smith was huge on R.E.M.
Yes, sure. Well, both Michael Stipe and Peter Buck were, despite the fact that they grew up, I mean, Peter was in the suburbs of Atlanta, and Michael lived in a town, little town called Collinsville, Illinois, which was essentially a suburb of St. Louis. And, you know, and in the mid-70s, there just wasn't a lot of like national big time media attention on like not just rock and roll, but like especially the more edgy artistic side of rock and roll. And so both of those guys ended up subscribing to the Village Voice, you know, the alternative newspaper from New York, which covered the sort of alternative music scene in New York very intensely. CBGBs and, you know, and those kind of, you know, the, you know, Max's Kansas City and the Mud Club and these kind of places where like the real leading edge kind of arty stuff came from. And Michael described reading about Patti Smith before he'd even heard her record her first record that came out in 1975, Horses. And so I think for him, as a kid who was both drawn to art and poetry and also punk rock, the idea that there could be this musician who wrote, who somehow seemed to kind of to draw from both sides of that, you know, to be able to write this fairly, you know, this poetry, this very emotionally intimate poetry, while at the same time setting it to really raw kind of, you know, punkish music, felt like a revelation to him, to both of those guys, to Peter and to Michael separately in their different communities. And so by the time they met in the late 70s, like in 1979, they were both like, you're a Patti Smith fan, I'm a Patti Smith fan. And so they, I think what they were both drawn to the same thing, which was the idea that you can sort of explore raw feelings and raw emotions and somehow split the difference between, you know, raw ideas and feelings and music that is still, you know, that has an urgency to it, but isn't necessarily just pounding cacophonous punk music. And so that Patti Smith record became kind of a signpost for both of them.
I went to see U2 at the Sphere in Las Vegas.
Ah,
it was amazing. So great. But one of the thoughts I had was REM broke up too soon. They should be playing. They could do a residency here too. Are they gone forever? You think we'll see them play again, or what?
Well, they said, I mean, one of the things about that band that, like, from the get-go was that they were going to resist the standard sort of tropes and standard sort of behaviors of rock bands. And they were, you know, they kind of made a list of the various expectations that the music industry had for rock bands and just essentially said, we're not doing any of that stuff. You know, and part of it, like that I said earlier, like, we're not gonna like parcel out our personal lives for column inches. We're not doing that. We're not gonna, you know, and at first it was like, we're not making videos, or we're definitely not gonna make videos that look anything like videos that are on MTV. We're not gonna publish our lyrics. We're not gonna make the lyrics understandable. We're not gonna do stuff like, you know, like at first at IRS, it was like one of the first things that the president of that company, or vice president, Jay, you know, Boberg, what he said was like, I'd love for you guys to work with this producer who makes cool artistic records, but he makes them so that they can be on the radio. And one of the things that he did was overdubbed a lot of sort of synthesized, you know, this kind of glossy synthesizer filigree that was in so many songs in the early 80s, which he did to Catapult, a song that's on Murmur, and as kind of a sampler, they recorded that, a version of that, and then he overdubbed these keyboards and sent it to them, and they were like, it's a completely, there's nothing especially wrong with it to what he did to the song, but it's just not them. You know, it's a perfectly arty, not uncool treatment of the song, but it's not them. And so they were like, no way are we letting this come out. And Boberg, to his credit, understood that he had brought them oranges when they were you know, an Apple band. And so he's like, okay, I get it. And so they'd made a practice of that throughout their career, what they would not do. And, you know, and once they broke up in 2011, it was like every major band that breaks up somehow inevitably gets back together, you know, and you can anticipate what that would mean for them. They would go and play Coachella, you know, they would play like some major festival and get a lot of attention for that. And then once, you know, in the aurora of that huge moment, that's when you announce the reunion tour. And suddenly it's like, wait a minute, I can see this in St. Louis. I'm in, you know, and then you rake in another, you know, $100 million or whatever. And that's a great thing, you know, and get a second bite at that particular apple. But, you know, but they've resisted. When they broke up, they were like, we are not ever getting back together again, period. And for a long time, they made a practice, even when the four of them were at the same event, you know, like maybe playing a fundraiser for a friend or doing something, even if two or three of them played together and the fourth one was in the room, that the fourth guy would like leave the room. So there wouldn't be an expectation that they were going to all four be on stage together. And that held forever until last June, when they were inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame. And I think that was significant enough for all four of them that they decided to actually step up on stage at the induction ceremony, and they played a kind of a fun acoustic version of Losing My Religion. And then that was like a big deal. Like, oh my God, like the four members of REM actually performed a song. And then a few months or just the other week, the actor Michael Shannon has formed a band with a musician named Jason Narducci, and they've been going around performing REM songs, sort of as a tribute band. They came to play the 40 Watt in Athens, and all four members of REM went to see the show and then came up on stage at the same time. And it was sort of like, I think Peter was playing guitar and Bill Berry was just playing a tambourine, and Michael sang a little backing vocals, and Mike Mills probably pitched in on vocals too. But it wasn't like they were all with their instruments playing. But they're
Well,
pretty consistent about not getting back together. But who knows? You know, I mean, I think it's not just the money. It's not just a financial question. I think it's just a question of, it's kind of fun to be who you were when you were at your greatest.
sure. Also, after Talking Heads broke up, David Byrne made some wonderful solo records and has had a great solo career. But I sort of assumed there would be a lot of Michael Stipe records, but that hasn't happened.
Well, he was one of his initial things. I mean, as much as he was interested in being a rock star from the time he was a teenager, and he was extremely interested in that, he was also very interested in visual arts. And, you know, and especially as he spent those years at art school at University of Georgia, you know, and he was, you know, pursuing photography. He was also a very talented painter. And I think that was, you know, and that's as much part of his expression as music. And so he didn't sing at all or didn't do anything for 10 years or something. And then he began to kind of slowly piece together a solo record, which he says he's still working on. And he released a few songs, two or three songs a couple of years ago, or I think during the pandemic. And there was a sense that a record, the full solo album, is going to come soon, but obviously it still isn't with us.
Soon, but
So
not
he's
yet.
taking his time. I mean, one of the things that they've done, which is sort of nice, is, you know, they broke up after 31 years. They were so much more successful than I think they ever imagined they would be, and and made way more money than they ever, you know, than anyone could ever really use. So they all four just kind of went to being doing exactly what they wanted to do, you know. I mean, and so Peter like hangs out around Portland with Scott McCoy, who is their sort of utility musician, and they co-produce records and they play in like half a dozen different bands and are constantly performing because Peter loves to play rock and roll in clubs, so he does that all the time. You know, Mike Mills has collaborated with a friend of his who's a classical violinist, and they've been sort of adapting REM music and other music for sort of quasi-symphonic performances. And you know, Bill Berry is hanging around Athens, you know, working on his farm and playing music with his friends when he feels like it. And Michael Stipe just goes around the world hanging out with his artistic friends and going to exhibits that he's interested in and taking photos and posting them on the internet. And it seems like they're all having a grand time.
It is very nice. This book is not an authorized biography, but you did have some cooperation. Who did you speak to, and how into it were they?
Well, they didn't. They made a point of saying, "Well, we don't want to cooperate with this." Like, no offense, because I knew Peter fairly well from Portland, and I'd met the other guys, and I knew their manager pretty well. As, you know, as a friend of mine. But they were like, "Well, you know, it's like we just don't want to have a like go ahead and do it. Like, we think it'll probably be okay, but like, we're just not interested in talking about REM or being REM members anymore. Like, we left that behind." And I understood that. And so I didn't really do big interviews per se with any of them, but you know, through the process, you know, they all found ways to be kind, 'cause they're nice. And so they all, encourage their friends and relatives to talk to me. And so that opened up some doors. And Peter, I could go to Peter just casually. And if I got stuck on something, like what happened here? Like, do I have this right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he would clarify stuff for me from time to time.
Do you know if they've read the book and how they feel about it?
I don't know. I don't know. I sort of doubt. I don't know if they would. I sent a copy to Peter. I was like, do you want to see one? Like, because he tends to look at my work when it comes out. Just because he likes books about music and I write books about music. So, and so I was like, do you want me to send you one? He's like, yeah, sure. He goes, sign. He goes, put in a fulsome dedication and I'll put it on my shelf and I'll never look at it. Or, so I was like, okay, that sounds fair. But, who knows? Maybe he will. Hopefully I'll bump into him and I can ask him. But, anyway. But yeah, no, I don't really have any expectation. Like, I don't know that I would ever want to, there was an interesting thing that happened after the REM book came out. A friend of mine sent me a thing he'd seen on Amazon where there appeared to be a biography of me, which is extraordinary because why would anybody care? And there it was, the biography of Peter Ames Carlin. And I was like, what the hell? So I ordered a copy. And it showed up, and it was some sort of AI production, and it was just a lot of abstract assertions about what writers do with the names of people I'd written about, sort of salted in, and my name salted in. But they didn't know anything about me. But I was sort of curious, like, what if somebody did some reporting? Like, what would that be like? And part of me, I knew it couldn't possibly be that much about me, but it was like, I think if you, but it was, I glanced at it, but it was excruciating. And I can't imagine for somebody, I mean, those guys know that I did some legwork and I spoke to their intimates and everything. And so, yeah, there's going to be stuff in there. But why would you want to read about your life?
You've written an Amazon review. I am Peter Ames Carlin, and this book is ridiculous and don't buy
That's exactly what I did.
it.
I gave it one star.
Well, your Bruce Springsteen book. I remember after we spoke, when that book came out, I went somewhere and it was at the airport. It was in every bookstore. It was everywhere, that book. And that was like, I think that was much more exposure than you'd had with your previous books. And it was a bestseller and so on. So how is REM doing, this book?
I think it's done really well. It did it got a lot of attention, which was super gratifying, and it got a lot of sort of serious literary attention, which was even more gratifying. And that was nice. But I don't really get hard sales numbers, other than occasionally looking to see how it's doing on Amazon or whatever. But I think it did, I think it's done okay. And I feel, I know the people at Doubleday are really happy with it. So, and it's just, there's been in some, media, the other way you kind of measure it is how much ongoing demand is there for like interviews and, articles and stuff. And so that stuff's been kind of ongoing. And it's like usually it goes on for a couple months and fades away, but I get like a steady stream of requests on this book.
Including for
And
me.
here we are.
I've always enjoyed your writing, but I think your writing has gotten, I mean, it was always good, but I think it's gotten much better. I really think this book is very artistically written and it's a really good read.
Thank you. Yeah, it's weird. It's like you go and it's like when I wrote the you're always trying to improve. I mean, I think everybody who does anything is always trying to be better than they were last time around. And there are certain things when I go back and look over earlier stuff I wrote, it's like, geez, that sucked. Or like, I can't believe I let that sentence stand. It used to be because it's like that's lazy. Or the McCartney book is the one I wrote was I wrote it kind of, I still had a full-time job then, and that was when I remember having to stay up late and work, like at, come home from my newspaper job and have dinner with my family, and then just go to my office and work until midnight or 1 or 2, wake up the next morning and do it again. And so there was, I didn't get the chance to really focus on every word and little bit of punctuation that I eventually got into. So I keep trying to find new and more, hopefully, more sophisticated ways to express ideas. So,
Do you know what you'll write about next?
well, it's already done. I'm just finishing, putting some finishing touches on the copy edit now. It's another book about Bruce Springsteen, and it's a deep dive into the making of Born to Run, which is pegged to the 50th anniversary of that album in August.
Yeah, great. Oh, good. When he was on the cover of Time and Newsweek in the same week.
Exactly. Which is precisely the chunk of a chapter I was working on earlier this morning. So,
Oh, good. Well, will you come back and talk to Bruce when the book comes out?
sure, happily.
All right, great. The new book is called The Name of This Band is REM, and the author, the brilliant Peter Ames Carlin, thanks so much for joining us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.